the context of the tradition of the Prophet, his manners and his mannerisms will fall outside of the term bid'at. It will not be an instance of bid'at. When we look at Islamic history, we see that the Prophet himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he mourned on the occasion of the death of certain individuals that were dear to him. For example, he mourned on the death of his uncle, Abi Talib, his son Ibrahim, and others. So we can't say that these acts of mourning are an instance of bid'at. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the concept of bid'at and its relation to mourning for the death of the infallibles. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Seven, very much pressure.
We come to you, and O God, name that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The concept of love and hate is something that is rife amongst all civilizations. You know, we have certain cultures that said, no, just love. It's all about love. I know we had the trends in certain eras of the world where it was all about love and don't hate and all these type of things. And there were certain places where, or certain times during the world where it, hate and destruction kind of ruled and was the governing force throughout the world. Islam, on the other hand, teaches a type of moderation, the middle way, where a person must love and hate, but for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for the sake of God. But the conditions are put out in front of you of who you should love, why and why you should love that person. And on the same side, or rather, regarding who you should hate and why you should hate that person. It is not just this, oh, you hate this person, why? Because I said so. No. There is hate for the reason of being hate, for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala dislikes a certain thing that that person is doing. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today deals with this issue. It deals with love, it deals with hate, and obviously it deals with it in a manner in which God, or which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is the central figure in deciding when to do, or rather when to love and when to hate. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be introducing the book that deals with this topic to our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is titled Love and Hate for God's Sake. As we mentioned in the first segment, that, you know, Islam gives a middle way. There is a certain manner in which this is done. There are conditions by which hate, or where a person can actually ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to remove his mercy from a particular person. It is not haphazard. It is not just, you know, for selfish desires or for humanistic, you know, protocols, if you want to call them that. Rather, there is a criteria by which has been set out by a higher authority that knows me better than myself and said, okay, in order for you to get benefit from this dunya and for you to perfect yourself, this, or rather, these are those who you should love and these are those who you should hate and therefore stay away from, and the ones you love you should attach yourselves to. And this is basically what the book, or the title of the book anyway, tells us. So again, the book whose title is Love and Hate for God's Sake was written by Mujtaba Saburi, originally in Persian. It was then translated by Salim Bimji. It was published by Al-Fath Al-Mubin Publications, which can be found, or which is, you know, in Canada, to my knowledge. So anyway, this particular text, this particular book, you know, aims to first explain the difference amongst the certain terms and technical, you know, terminology that we have regarding the concept of hate. Such terms such as sab, which means to swear or to curse, or shatam, and la'an. And then after, you know, speaking about these three particular terms, obviously seeing that these three terms have difference in meaning, the author then focuses on the term of la'an, exploring its status from the Islamic point of view by delving into the relevant sources. So in order to understand the word la'an better, the author then goes towards the verses of the glorious Quran, the prophetic traditions, which is obviously the ahadith, and the conduct of the Muslim, that is the seerah of the Muslims in general. So how did the Muslims in general use la'an and use cursing, rather, you know, cursing, which means the removal of God's mercy from somebody? When did they use it? How did they use it? Was it looked down upon? Was it forbidden? All of that should be discussed in this particular book. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a section of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. Now let us hear from the translator of this book, my dear friend, Brother Salim Bimji.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Salim Bimji, the translator of Love and Hate for God's Sake. This digital book of around 60 pages focuses on, as the title suggests, love and hate, not merely as emotions we feel as human beings, but how we should channel these powers in the way of Allah. Now, as Muslims that follow the Quran and Ahlul Bayt, we are sometimes confronted by other Muslims as to why we show hate or dislike to certain historical personalities, what is referred to as evoking la'nat. In order to make it clear to the majority Muslim community, as well as the Shia Muslims, in regards to how we view history and historical figures, I decided to translate this book and publish it digitally for global consumption. As the reader goes through the work, they will see that Allah has introduced the concept of love and hate multiple times in the Quran. There are multiple verses of the Quran which speak of this, including examples from the past prophets. We also examine some historical examples from the life of Prophet Muhammad, may Allah bless him and his family. And we even review examples where companions of the Prophet engaged in la'nat upon one another. This work goes on to show how la'nat is not an attack on Muslim unity or historical personalities, if understood correctly. We end the book by quoting 40 verses of the Quran dealing with la'nat, the first step in hate for God's sake, which will eventually lead to love for the sake of God. I pray that those who read this book do so with an open mind and with the aim of improving their relationship with Allah.
That was Brother Salim Bimji, the translator of the book Love and Hate for God's Sake. Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. Just to recap, the book that we introduced to our dear listeners was called Love and Hate for God's Sake. It was written by Brother Mujtaba Saburi and translated by Brother Salim Bimji and published in Canada. It is very likely that this book is not physically published because, as my research showed, there is a electrical copy of it available online. So, as mentioned in our previous segment, the book discusses the meanings of certain words that can be seen in the traditions regarding, you know, saying something about someone else. Not nice things, obviously, but saying certain things about someone else and the intention of the person behind saying it. So one of the chapters in this book is called Meanings of Cussing. So cussing is the translation of sab, and malediction of la'an, and their differences. There is a difference between malediction and cussing. So there is a difference between la'an and sab. In Islam, cussing is forbidden, it is haram. And in the books of a lexicon, sab is defined as cussing and the usage of profanities. So basically you are swearing at somebody, you are degrading them in a particular manner. Al-Zubaydi has stated as-sab is defined as cussing. Ibn Mandur has stated that al-shatam means offensive speech, and there is no requirement that in such speech defamation occurs. Al-Turayhi has stated al-shatam means to describe something such as to show a deficiency within it. Islam has prohibited the acts of cussing and the use of vulgar language, just as God the Most High has stated in the Holy Quran in Surah An'am, the 6th chapter of Holy Quran, verse 108, do not cuss those whom they invoke besides God, lest they should abuse God out of hostility without any knowledge. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to understand the teachings of Islam, to practice them, and to be of those who are the close servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar inghar mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
We seek refuge in Allah from the accursed Satan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program that is dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And it's about his life and times. And once again, I'm joined by my good friend, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on the subject of Imam Khomeini's life and times. And I like to say salam and welcome him to the program.
Alaikum salam rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for giving us your valuable time. Sir, we are on the subject of leadership, and there's a growing lack of it in the West.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason. Because, of course, you know, there's crisis upon crisis of what's happening in the West at the moment. So take us into the difference, really, between what happened here in 1979 and what's going on in the West since then.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think this is a very good subject to talk about, and it really is one of those basic issues.
That if
we're able to correctly analyze it and collect and correctly and, you know, deeply try to understand it, it can really open the doors for a lot of other issues.
Absolutely.
It's the key that opens up a lot of the doors for other issues.
Mm.
And, you know, if we want to maybe, if we want to at the beginning maybe give some headings, like crisis of leadership in the West, you know, the supreme leader.
Yes.
You know, religious leadership.
Absolutely.
Walayat Faqih.
Yes.
Right? So these are things, you know, when we talk about having Walayat Faqih, when we talk about having a Islamic scholar, a faqih, a person
who is...
A jurist or jurisprudent.
Yes.
Who is, you know, an expert in laws.
Yes.
Being the leader of a society. Of a nation, and you know, this is versus other ways and other kinds of leadership.
Absolutely,
this is what we're talking about. This is what a big part of the revolution was about.
Yes,
this is a big part of what we when we're talking about governance in Islam, in the religion of Islam, according to Islam, in the time when the Prophet and the Imams are not physically present.
That's correct, yes.
You know, we're talking about, well, what kind of a leadership do you have?
Exactly.
Okay. And, of course, that's related to the larger issue of what kind of a political system you have.
Of course.
And you know, this is the beautiful thing that we can see in Iran, is that we have a situation where we have a very deep, complex, and sophisticated political system in which we have, you know, elected officials on the local and on national level. We have a parliament. We have a independent judiciary.
Sure.
And an elected president, executive. And then above this whole system, which is, and the system being a way in which the people are participating in their lives, in their political life, in their social life, in their economic life, in the decision makings that affect them, on top of this system, as a person who is able to guide it, who's able to steer it in the right direction, who's able to prevent it from, you know, going to either extreme, we have a supreme leader.
Exactly.
And who, as you know, we were mentioning, is a religious person.
Exactly. And the fact is that the constitution reflects that, doesn't it?
Exactly. And so this is something when we had, you know, as we've seen in history, we've had a person like, you know, Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
And after Imam, we have Ayatollah Khamenei, who's the leader.
Yeah.
Now, I'm saying all this, and what I'm trying to point out is that let's look at what the alternatives have been.
Yes, I mean,
and what effect this has had on the societies, on the politics.
Well, what we still have today in the Middle East. I mean, this is the real issue, isn't it?
Not only in the Middle East.
Yeah.
If we look at it, because we were talking about the crisis in the West,
but of course, you know,
right? Exactly. You know, these are things that when you talk about it, that it's really, you know, I think if you put aside prejudice and if you put aside some of the you know, brainwashing that people get in the West,
propaganda, basically,
and the propaganda, you will see that it has been to the benefit of Iran,
yes,
to have this kind of leadership,
to have a jurist in control,
to have a system of Walayat Faqih. Yeah. It's been to the benefit, and I'm talking about benefit materially.
Mm.
You know, by those standards which, you know, politicians and politics and political systems and economic systems are measured.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
That's a very, very
So this is the point.
Yes.
So putting that aside for a second, we can come back to that in terms of looking at the positive side of it. Let's look at the negative side of it.
Right.
I'm talking about the West now,
for example.
For example, you have a system, and we've talked about this many times before in different programs, where, for example, in the States, in the United States, you have a leadership, you have an elite who is not capable of defending and pursuing the interests of the United States, of the people of the United States.
No, they're not. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Whether it's the economic interests.
What happened to those three words that were so pronounced in the U.S. Constitution, we the people?
Right. And this is the point, which is that they pursue the elite interests.
Yes.
They pursue very narrow corporate interests.
Yes. And that's 0.1%.
Right.
It?
And then they come on TV and they're like, well, it's to your benefit.
It's to your benefit.
So this is the difference. Mm.
They're dictating to the people.
And these are supposed to be the higher level, you know, statesmen, the president, you know.
Yeah.
Forget about the local guys. I mean, it's all about, you know, money and, you know, who has the
wealth,
most money and you know, campaigning based on, you know, attack ads and, I mean, it's just completely dirty, you know.
Yes.
So we're talking, you know, we're not even talking about that aspect of it,
which is,
you know, forget about that.
Yes.
We're talking about leadership.
Leadership, yes.
We're talking
about the actual qualities that are required in an individual.
You know, we have a situation, and it wasn't always like this in the West.
No. They had statesmen.
Right. They had good leaders.
Yes.
You know, I always talk about De Gaulle.
Hmm.
In France,
in being, France,
an,
yes,
being
yes,
an example
yes.
of a pretty good leader,
yeah,
you know, for that society,
yes,
having moral courage, you know, standing up
for the French interests,
right,
for,
and you know, just basically being a person who
a patriot,
right, and being kind of selfless and not really trying to, you know, play politics in the
absolutely,
you know, base
this goes down well with the Scottish, you know,
right.
We understand that concept.
We'll see if we have to add Alex Salmond to that, but, but he seems to be doing a good job, so, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, De Gaulle having the war and, you know, liberation of France and so on.
But
I mean, so
you're quite right, sir, because there weren't many good statesmen,
right?
No,
and you
no
know,
doubt,
people talk about Churchill, you know.
Churchill, yes.
We can argue that. I mean, I don't think he was really a good leader in the sense that during the war, he, you know, he did what he had to do, which is to, you know, fight the war.
Yeah.
But other things, I think.
But he tops the poll as far as.
Well, all I'm saying is
UK
that
is
in
concerned.
terms of being a leader during the war.
He was very effective.
But, you know, there are a lot of major things that were horrible about, you know, what he did.
Throughout his there was a lot of criminal things,
including chemical weapons.
The chemical weapons used on Kurds, you know, which brings back memories of 1990.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know. But the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, we really have a crisis in the West.
That's right.
In terms of leadership. We
moral and
right. I mean, if you look at the quality of, let's say, U.S. presidents.
Yes, yes. Why did it decline into towards the evolutionary scale of Darwinism? That instead of, you know, man evolving from apes, it went from man to ape.
Right. I mean, these are things that are, you know, it's a problem. Because, I mean, if you look at, I don't know, you know, if you want to look at it from a, you know, sympathetic perspective, you know, you had people like Eisenhower. Okay, I mean,
yes, I mean, Dwight,
you know, we don't really like him here because he, you know, did the coup. But the point I'm trying to make is that,
but
you know,
he was a very effective.
But you know, and for U.S. standards, he was pretty good.
He was a very good statesman. Yes,
you know, or if you look at somebody like, you know, I would even say Nixon compared to some of the people that we have these days. You know, we're not talking about the domestic things.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
but
sure,
internationally, but, you know. Mm.
Nixon went to China.
Right, started a strategic vision, you know, tried to end the Vietnam War, you know.
Sure.
Did a lot of things.
He lived up to some aspects
of
his,
I mean, there was a feeling there that you felt like there was something beyond themselves.
Exactly.
There was something beyond just narrow, you know, special interests that
they were
pursuing.
That's very
and
good,
a lot of them would even stand up to certain streams within their own party and within their own political movement in order to do what they thought was right for the country. So these are rare, and it just doesn't happen anymore.
No.
You know, if you just look across the board, if you look at one of these EU, you know, summits, or if you look at one of these, you know, G20 summits and whatever, I mean, how many of these people would you consider to be statesmen? How many of them would you consider to be moral leaders?
Exactly.
Because it's about moral leadership.
Exactly. My question to you, Dr. Tarabi, is this. Is it deliberate?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the whole idea of moral leadership is completely out the window in the West.
Yeah.
You know, we have this idea. The reason why we have, you know...
Is that just a generational decline?
I think it's something you make fun of now. It's not...
I think so, yeah.
You know, it's like you say, well, we need a moral leader. Like, yeah, get out of here. What are you talking about, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas in Islam, the whole point of a leader is that he is the moral compass.
Exactly, because we have to live up to the standards of the Sharia.
and Quran and try to live according to the way, you know, Allah wants us to. So we need a person who himself
is a model.
Is a moral embodiment of that.
Yeah.
So this is the difference when we talk about, for example, in Shiism, we're insisting on the imams. And imam means, you know, leader.
It
means leader.
It literally means leader.
When we insist on the imams being the leaders of Islam, as opposed to, you know, the khalifas or whatever other views there were, it's because they were not only, they were also the embodiments of those values of Islam that they were trying to implement.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't, didn't have this problem of people talking about Islam, but they themselves being, you know, unjust people.
That's a very good point that you're raising.
And it's an ayah in the Quran.
Yes.
It talks about, you know, those who enjoin others or those who command others to justice, and they are just themselves.
To do good, to do righteousness.
They are just themselves.
Yeah. Yes.
This is the difference.
This is the contradiction, isn't it? Because this is the crisis that we're really talking about in the West, that the leaders who you know, espouse human rights and who, you know, give all kinds of niceties or pleasantries about all sorts of things, but
things that nobody would disagree with.
Nobody would disagree, but they don't live up to those.
Well, personal, of course not. Not only do they not live up to it,
they're as corrupt and rotten to the core.
Right. It's not only that they don't live up to it; it's exactly the opposite.
It's sheer hypocrisy.
Right. They talk about, you know, human rights and human dignity, and then they go around killing people around the world.
Exactly.
What I'm trying to say is that this goes back to moral character. Things like moral character, things like an ethical life.
Sure.
Things like, you know, having a personal ethical standard for yourself, which, again, it's not even so much that they don't, it's beyond the fact that they don't have it anymore. It's like something that you make fun of now.
Mm.
Whereas in Islam, and, you know, alhamdulillah, thank God we have Walayat Faqih.
Mm.
Thank God we have Walayat Faqih.
Thanks to the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and it really, if anybody doubts this, they should come to Iran and they should see it themselves, what a positive effect this has, whether it's in terms of, you know, keeping the ship, you know, on course,
yes.
And whether it's on the left or on the right, trying to, you know, go to either extreme, you have that leadership, whether it's about, you know, raising those basic issues in society and pointing out those problems if the governments are not doing their job.
Mm.
Or if certain things that are going amiss is mentioned by the Supreme Leader, or whether it's encouraging certain things, I'll give you a very clear example.
Please.
If you look at the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, during his tenure and during the time that he's been the Supreme Leader, his focus has been on and the thing that he's been, you know, constantly talking about and making a priority is scientific advancement.
Exactly.
And knowledge and building a scientific society in terms of having, you know, Iran advance when it comes to all sorts of knowledge, whether it's technical and scientific in terms of the hard sciences, or whether it's, you know, humanities or whatever subjects there are.
Yeah, whatever fields there are. Yeah, absolutely.
And you see an incredible thing happening in these 20 years in Iran, which is you have a country which is very backward, you know, 40 years ago in terms of science, doesn't have its own you know, scientific life, really, is just a place where theories, you know, developed other places are imitated, or worse, where, you know, when it comes to technical things, and you're an engineer,
you know,
bringing in foreign engineers.
Thank you for reminding me.
Bringing in foreign engineers to do very simple tasks.
That's right.
So we have this massive transformation happening in Iran because it is insisted upon by the leader, and it is insisted in the sense that he says that when the governments come, and whoever is going to come, and it doesn't matter from which side of the political spectrum, and, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, who it is, a priority has to be the scientific advancement of the society. And we see incredible advancements.
Of course.
Things that are acknowledged by the different, you know, non-governmental organizations which, you know, are working in this field globally, which have nothing to do with Iran, and, you know, there's no need for them to try to,
and the fact
you
that
know, talking about this, how advanced Iran has become. So this is one example of when you have a leadership that comes and says to whoever is the government, it's fine, you do those things that you promised and the things that you
run the affairs.
But these
the
things
state.
have to be set in society.
So,
I'll give you another example: the idea of taking care of the poor and the weak.
You know, we're talking about welfare.
You know, we have this thing in the West where, you know, it's just become, I mean, this goes back to Thatcher and Reagan. And,
oh, of course it does.
You know, these guys that they're like, oh, you know, you don't want to take care of the poor anymore.
No.
Or you don't care about the poor anymore. Or it's their fault that they're poor.
Yes.
you know. And so, yeah, of course there's been abuse of the welfare system and so on. We're not denying that. But, you know, the basic idea that you would help the weaker members
of society. And that's a measure of civilization,
like, elderly people who've worked their whole life, who are maybe now not capable of working that
much. Right.
You know,
And they're entitled to certain rights and certain benefits.
Yeah, we're not talking about people who are you know, just lazy bums who are not doing anything. We're talking about people who work 30, 40, 50 years.
And they're entitled to something at the end of the day.
You got to take care of them.
Yes.
We're talking about people who are maybe physically disabled or who are mentally disabled. We're not talking about, you know, so these are things that in a society which has a moral leadership, which has a leader that bases his actions and his speeches and the way he guides society on a certain set ethical moral framework, these things are not going to be put aside in a society because somebody got the vote and, you know, they're going to come in and they're going to change everything, you know, from top to bottom and whatever. So, you know, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about that there are certain things in every society, whether you're talking about the, you know, Islamic society or in the East or in the West or in Europe, that require a moral leader to maintain it.
Yes.
To safeguard it. To not allow those dynamics that happen in every society
to decline or to be...
Right.
Yeah.
And this is one of the great values. I would also like to point out this. This is something that some of the, you know, even Western experts talk about, which is that when you have a leadership, as you have in the West, which is so a result, a derivative, a consequence of money and moneyed interests and special interests, well, that's not really a leadership. You know, you don't have honest leadership.
No.
You know what I mean?
Or visionary leadership.
Right. You don't have a person taking chances. You don't have a person... as you were saying very correctly, you know, presenting a vision.
Yeah.
It's always tactics. It's always politics. How are we going to get to the next election?
It's the short term, though.
Right. How are we going to get to the next elections? How is this going to play out in the media? Yeah. How is this going to work out, you know, with Congress?
With the greatest profitability for my backers or my supporters.
Exactly. Yeah. Or my party or whatever.
Or my party,
Whereas if you have a leadership like Walid Faqih, which is above these matters.
Exactly.
Which is what some of the people, when they talk about the king having a royal system, you know, like those who advocate constitutional monarchy.
Constitutional
monarchy, like in Britain or in some of the Western European countries.
And we still haven't got a constitution.
Right.
There we are.
The problem with that and the difference is this. Yes, I agree in principle that a good king can have that function in a society.
He does, yes.
Or
that's
a queen,
true.
Right?
That's true.
But unfortunately what we see is that these kings and queens are not really... because they're... you see, this is the difference between having a religious leadership...
Based on merit.
On merit. A scholar, a faqih, somebody who has...
qualified for
that. Who has struggled themselves to get to this both intellectual and academic position and also moral and spiritual position, because this is a moral, a spiritual, you have to have that level of it as well in order to be able to guide a society.
Right.
You know, you can't just be some, you know, whatever, you know, guy that just comes along and gets the votes and okay, well, I'm going to be the moral leader now. You know, you have to work on yourself, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
And again, age is also maybe not necessarily... It doesn't have to be an old person. It could be like, you know...
Berlusconi wouldn't qualify.
Right. Exactly. You know what I mean? I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, this new Pope, Pope Francis, you know, he's saying good things.
Yes.
You know, he's saying nice things. Yeah. We like what he's saying, you know, about the poor and helping the poor and, you know,
bringing those
not being so, you know, ostentatious, the church not being so ostentatious and so on.
Yes.
I mean, we have issues when it comes to celibacy and...
Yeah, other issues.
There are other issues.
Yeah, yes, true.
But, you know, this is what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
I'm talking about somebody who was a little bit above this, who was above the fray.
Yes.
Okay, the kings were supposed to do that. The queens were supposed to do that.
To do that.
Well, they're not doing that.
No.
They basically become, you know, these rich elites that, you know...
Exactly. They're, you know, they're part and parcel of the same
running around on the jet set and, you know, going on ski vacations and going
That's
on Caribbean
right.
vacations.
And costing the taxpayer enormous amount of money.
Right. So these are not, you know... In principle, when those that defend monarchy in those countries or constitutional monarchy, when they talk about that, yes, the principle is correct that you would have somebody above the fray. But what we see historically is that none of that has happened.
No.
When was the last time you had a king who was morally... you know,
yeah,
leading the country.
Sure.
And you know, setting
well, this. Well, I can't recall one, put know. It that way. Yes.
Right. I mean, maybe 100 years ago, 200 years ago, something. But
something, you know, maybe down the line,
right.
Yes.
And again, the difference is that when you have a royal system that's based on, you know, hereditary
yes.
monarchy.
Monarchy, yeah.
You know, which is kind of a lottery, right?
Yes.
We always talk about that.
That's right. Yes, right. Yes.
You know, a certain kind of lottery.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Depending on, you know, who, you know, your father and your mother.
Yes. Prince Charles still weeps.
Right.
Yes.
So, you know, these are things that obviously are going to affect that leadership, as opposed to,
yeah.
you know, as you were explaining, a system in which a person is chosen based on their own merits.
On their own merits.
And
yes.
remember, the supreme leader is somebody that comes and is chosen. It's an indirect election.
Yes.
The people elect the assembly of experts.
And the experts.
And the assembly of experts. You know, appoint, select a supreme leader.
Supreme leader,
and they're able to, you
sure,
know,
sure.
which you can't. I mean, with a king, what are you going to do? You can't impeach a king, right?
No, you can't. Yes, I remember that since Charles the First.
Right. Yes. So, you know, this is a problem with having kings. Is, you know, once you got them, you got them.
I mean, you got them. Yes.
I mean, how long
get rid of them until
right,
death do us part?
How long has, you know, Elizabeth been around?
I mean, oh, she's been around for a long time. You know, this is why Charles weeps. You know, he really cries. You know, he wants mother off that throne as soon as possible.
Right.
You know.
So, you know, this is what we're talking about. We haven't even mentioned places like, you know, Saudi Arabia. We haven't mentioned places.
It's our favorite topic. But
you know,
we haven't mentioned,
you know, some of these, you know,
hereditary kings, are they?
We haven't mentioned, like, Azerbaijan hereditary presidents.
Their hereditary line doesn't go that far
right.
back.
So, I would categorize them. I mean, obviously, Saudi Arabia is a monarchy, but I mean, I would categorize, you know, it's the same principle that we're talking about.
Exactly, that's true.
But the unfortunate thing is that you have in the West a society and a civilization which actually did value moral leadership at some point.
At some point, that's true.
You know, where you have examples of that in its history, where you really had people, and of course you have it in the East as well. You have it, you know, we were talking about one of the khalifas, which was, you know, Umar bin Abdul Aziz, who was considered one of the good khalifa. You know, this is something that's really apparent in the West now.
I think so.
If you look
at
I
think this crisis has reached rock bottom, as they say, you know.
Yeah, and it has to do with the rise of basically this complete plutocracy, this kind of complete
the rule of the wealth.
Exactly. And rule of money, and this kind of domination of the whole system by money.
Money. By banks.
And special interests.
Yes,
you
special
know.
Interests. Yes.
And when we're talking about special interests, obviously when we talk about, you know, money, Zionism is right there.
Well, I mean, it's right there. I mean, they're all, they've all got those names, haven't they? You know, I don't want to go into that.
Right, what I'm trying to say is that this doesn't
Lehman, you know.
Right, what I'm trying to say is that this is together. You know, the fact that you would have a large, huge nation like the United States, 300 million people, not being able to pursue its own interests in the Middle East because of Israel or because of Al-Saud.
Yes.
And again, we've talked about this many times, but it bears repeating, which is that, you know, it would be in the interests of the American people
to do something in the interest of America.
To have good relations with Iran, for example.
Well.
You know.
That would
to
be
actually,
nice.
You know, say, you know what, let's bury the hatchet, you know, let's start it. You know, we recognize that you had a revolution. You know, fine. You kicked our guy out. That's okay. It's ancient history, as the Americans say. You know,
sure.
You know, let's get on with
it. Let bygones be bygones.
Let's get on with it.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, that would be in the interests of the American people. It would be in the interests of even the American elites.
Sure.
But unfortunately, you have, you know, the Israel lobby. You have the Saudi lobby, which doesn't allow American elites to make that move.
Well, the other thing,
and they don't have the courage to tell, you know, foreigners like the Israelis or like the Saudis hey, back off. This is our national interest.
Sure, but their short-term interests are in congruence with each other, aren't they?
Because exactly.
Absolutely
correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's the key point, which you were pointing out, which is that this is why the leadership can't do it, because they're only thinking short-term.
Yes.
They're thinking next elections. They're thinking Congress. They're thinking, you know,
My pocket, basically.
Right.
Yes.
You know, how are we going to get the funding? They're thinking, you know, media campaign. What's Fox News going to say? What's MSNBC going to say?
Exactly. It's all about image and so many other things.
Right. Which is why we mentioned the example of Nixon.
That's right.
You know, Nixon, being a conservative Republican anti-communist,
sure,
you know, gets up and goes to communist China.
Yeah.
and says, you know what, we're not going to recognize Taiwan, sure, the nationalist Chinese government, any longer. Mm. You know, it's a little island with a couple million versus, yes, you know, this massive...
massive continent, right? Yes.
Yes, it's true. Mm. It helped the Americans in fighting the Soviets and, yes, creating, a tripolar situation.
Sure.
In order to pit the Chinese against the Soviets. But still, you know, here you had a guy who you would not expect to have been friendly with communists in communist China.
Sure.
And
but he was basically doing it in the American interest.
But he realized that this is in the American interest. And he stood up against the people in his own party.
Of course, who were deadly against it.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is what we talk about when we talk about leadership. Mm. Okay, you can call it, I don't know if I would call that moral leadership, what Nixon did, but it was more visionary. It was a kind of leadership.
Yes.
Yes. You know what I mean?
Better than George Bush Jr.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or if you look at somebody, I mean, look, I'm trying to, you know, just bring examples. There's a lot of, you can, you know, make a lot of complaints about these examples. But you have somebody like Lyndon Johnson, you know, yes, who's from Texas, from the South. He's a Southern white, you know, growing up in that segregation environment, and yet he stands up for civil rights.
He was hands up for civil rights, yes.
So, you know, these are things that... And again, it might have not been easy for him to do that.
Sure, just in the last minute or so, Dr. Turabi, just sum up for us, really, you know, this crisis of leadership in the West.
Well, it's to sum it up, it's very simple.
Yes.
You have a system which is an Islamic system versus a secular system.
That's true.
In Islam, we say that the leader of a society has to himself be a moral person.
That's right.
Has to be a just person themselves in their own lives.
That's right.
Okay.
Personally, they must reflect
that. This is the difference. Mm. In secularism, they say if he is, that's good.
That's good.
But
that's
if he isn't, if he isn't, he isn't.
Right.
That's basically what's the difference is.
Sure.
You have a leadership system being presented in Islam in the time when the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the Imams are not present, which is the Walat Faqih, the leadership of the jurisprudent, who is the one that is able to guide society as an expert in law. And law in Islam is not the law of the West. Law is a manifestation of divine right and wrong.
Divine right and wrong.
Okay, right. In Islam, when we talk about Sharia, when we talk about laws, fiqh, faqih, this is a manifestation of what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad, as defined by the Creator. So we need a person who is there to guide society on this path.
Sure. Thank you very much, Dr. Mahdi Turabi, for your valuable contribution on the program today. It certainly enlightened us a lot about what is the reality of the crisis of leadership in the West. Thanks very much for that. And it just leaves me to say for our audience, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening to our program today. Goodbye.
Stream. While the current wave of resistance in the occupied West Bank is renewing itself through continuous resistance operations against the Zionist entity and its illegal colonial settlers, the Negev Desert over the past week has joined the series of surprises. After a long period of silence, during which the occupation thought that it could simply force the Palestinian residents to evacuate their villages, the recent uprising in the Negev came along to revive the Israeli nightmare of the Saif al-Quds. A threat to the state. The discussion here is not about Israel's paranoia with Iran's nuclear project nor Hezbollah's precise missiles. Rather, what Israel views as direct threat from the people of the Palestinian desert to its actual existence as an apartheid entity. After all, Ben-Gurion, the founder of the Zionist entity, was frank when he said, "If we do not stand firm in the desert, Tel Aviv will fall." This is a quotation that the Karen Kayameth Le'Israel Jewish National Fund used as its slogan decades ago for afforestation of the Negev Desert, addressing its projects entitled Achieving Ben-Gurion's Vision, while of course linking their plans to a number of God's promises exclusively to them. The Zionist occupation referred to the Palestinians of the Negev as the Bedouin problem. Finding a solution for this problem has been since 2005 the responsibility of the Israeli National Security Council, which explicitly means that in the eyes of the occupation, these native Palestinians constitute a demographic and existential danger and an explosive substance that contains violent energy for confrontation. The Knesset even approved in 2005 the Public Lands Law, which stipulates the eviction of public lands from any people, movable property, animals, or every building based on it and everything related to it permanently. For years, this law was used as a pretext to displace Palestinians from the Negev, whether by demolishing their homes, spraying their crops and livestock with toxic chemicals, or bulldozing their crops and planting trees unfamiliar to desert environment as an alternative, as well as imposing outrageous fines on Palestinians who dare enter their own land. The events underway in the Negev are but an episode of the series of devastation that the Palestinians experience there on a daily basis. Under the protection of the Zionist police and escorted by the bulldozers, members of the Jewish National Fund storm what they refer to as the unrecognized villages, raise the lands without any prior warning in preparation for fencing them and then confiscating them for the benefit of the illegal Zionist settlement project. This has been going on for such a long time that the native Palestinians realized they had no choice but to take matters into their own hands and reclaim their rights, because the law in that forest was never on their side. After all, what was taken by force can only be restored by force. Welcome to the Mideast Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. Although there are local reasons for the recent ignition of the Israeli campaign on the Negev, what this region is witnessing today is not far from the historical context established by David Ben-Gurion, since he declared that if Israel does not preserve the desert, then Tel Aviv will fall. A slogan regularly repeated by the Jewish National Fund, which had a remarkable role in establishing the Zionist entity and is working to implement this slogan in Negev with temporary settlement plans. Now, plans that are erected under the pretext of the Blooming of the Desert project as a cover for the displacement of native Palestinians. On the other hand, these Palestinians insist on clinging to their rights, railing with every possible tool the daily epic struggle and steadfastness. To discuss this issue with us from London is Ms. Sarah Wilkinson, a human rights advocate and supporter of Palestine from a very long time. Thank you very much for being with us, Sarah, to discuss the issue of the Negev. Now, the Israeli establishment with its various arms is masterful in clamping down on the people of the occupied Negev as far as 1948 and attempting to steal their land. But the past week, Zionists were actually surprised with the massive popular upheaval in the areas of Arab al-Atrash and Sa'wa, in scenes that brought back to the memory of the Intifada of the Palestinian people of 48. We're talking about the occupied territories inside of Palestine, especially during last May in the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds. How do you assess such a popular resistance by the 1948 Arabs?
I think recently what we've seen is some very, very coordinated campaigns which have mobilized people not just in Palestine but also internationally. The Save Sheikh Jarrah campaign, Save Sil, One Save Beta, they've all become quite well known, popularized. And so I think that, you know, the resistance against the ethnic cleansing, which is an ethnic cleansing of the Nakab, on a massive scale, some of the groundwork had already been laid. And so the Palestinians have become much more like one society, one force against Israeli occupation, which is and less fragmented, which is something that we've probably not seen for quite a long time. So the movement has been growing for many years. But I think the Save Sheikh Jarrah movement, with activists like Mohammed Al-Kurd and Munir Al-Kurd, that has popularized it. And it has made people aware of it all across the world. And it's laid the groundwork for such resistance, I think.
Well, Sarah, it seems that activists in the occupied Negev believe that the aim of this theft is to actually prevent the expansion of the natural expansion, by the way, of the Palestinian villages, and to impose restrictions on their people to force them to migrate again to other areas in occupied Palestine, knowing that the Israeli entity, since after the 1948 Nakba, had adopted the method of afforestation in the abandoned villages to practically just to obliterate Palestinian monuments, Palestinian history from those villages. We see a lot of images and photos of old houses eaten up by Mother Nature because of this attempted afforestation by the Zionist entity. So it's a matter of actual survival for these Palestinians versus an illegal expansion of the Zionist settlement in Negev. In the case Israel decides to ups the ante against the Bedouins, Sarah, will there be coordinated resistance similar to what we saw last May?
Well, this is it. Whether the Palestinians can maintain or sustain this amount of resistance, this is a huge area we're talking about. It's like 3.3 million acres, if I'm right. I don't know what that is in dunams, but it's a massive area. So, and the attempt from the Zionists to take over the Nakab region, that's been going on for decades, probably since 1948. So it's been renewed. With the JNF funding, renewed funding, actually experimental weaponry as well is being used against them. So it's been renewed under the guise of this forestation, urbanization, the new Tel Aviv city, if you like, that's going to be built over the top of these ethnically cleansed Bedouin villages, of which 70 villages, I think, are under threat, or around 70 villages. So this plan has been going on for decades, but what the Israelis have done is renewed it under the pretext of forestation. Well, we're quite aware that during 1948, over 500 villages were ethnically cleansed. They were wiped off the map, and forestation was one of the ways that they buried these ethnically cleansed villages with non-indigenous trees to make the new settlers more welcome, or they found the trees more welcoming. Of course, that caused forest fires, which in turn, I think the sinister part of the plot was probably the Israelis don't mind about the forest fires because it finished off the villages and prevents them from returning home. So this plan has been going on for a long time, but it's been revised to look like something that politicians are more likely to want to invest in. It's like a greenwashing. But we must never forget, this is a massive ethnic cleansing on a massive scale. And the Israelis aren't just going to turn around because there is some resistance. What it will do is will continue an onslaught, an invasion of the Nakab until it gets what it wants. And yes, the idea is to force 70 or 90,000 Bedouin into small areas near the nuclear reactor, the Dimona reactor, where the ground is toxic.
Because so they want to move the people, they want to move the native Palestinians closer to Dimona?
Yeah, I think there's three areas. I think Beersheba is one. I forget one, but the other one is Dimona. But we know that 55-year-old nuclear reactor has been leaking. The Israelis have been handing out, they've actually been distributing anti-radiation pills to the Israelis who live and work there. So they know the area isn't safe. So you move 70 communities into these 27,000 acres, bearing in mind 3.3 million acres is where they come from, into a tiny 27,000 acre region that is not safe for subsistence farming. What you're doing is not just ethnically cleansing them by making them migrate, you're actually shortening their life expectancy. So actually it's a double ethnic cleansing. I think it's quite sinister to be moving subsistence farmers that work on the land, that have sheep, livestock, cattle, into areas that are not safe to farm in.
Well, that definitely will open up a lot of doors to the actual reason that would push Tel Aviv to do this to the Palestinians, who already know as an occupation this is something that they have been doing for the past century, but specifically with the Bedouin crisis, moving them closer to such a very high risky area, which kind of seems like they're using them as human shields to protect.
Yes.
Basically, whatever they are hiding in that area. But it's been a pleasure having you on, Sarah Wilkinson, human rights advocate and supporter of Palestine. I'm sorry that we are out of time, but I promise that we will have you more to talk about this. Sadly, we need to talk more about this as much as we can. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for your time. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the Iranian-Syrian new economic ties.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
While Syrian President Bashar Assad and Iranian Transport and Urban Development Minister Rostam Ghazemi discussed last week bilateral relations, especially at the economic level. Now, President Assad stressed the importance of establishing new projects that achieve the common strategic benefit of Syria and Iran and link the business sectors in both countries. The joint discussions also dealt with ways to expand bilateral work in the public and private sectors and encourage joint investments with the aim of giving a new drive to trade and economic ties. For his part, Minister Ghazemi reiterated his country's firm position in supporting the steadfastness of the Syrian population in the face of the horrific war, the terrorist war that they have been facing, and Iran's keenness to expand cooperation between the two countries in all fields that serve the interests of the two friendly peoples. Iran and Syria to expand trade ties in this following report.
Iranian Minister of Transport and Urban Development Rostam Ghazemi arrived in Syria last week, heading a high-level economic and political delegation to discuss ways to develop economic cooperation between the two countries. Upon his arrival at Damascus Airport, where he was received by Syrian Economy Minister Mohammad Samer al-Khalil and Iranian Ambassador to Syria Mahdi Subhani, Minister Ghazemi stressed the determination of Tehran and Damascus to achieve real economic and trade partnership. For his part, the Syrian Minister of Economy affirmed that his country seeks comprehensive cooperation with Iran, hoping the meeting will lead to good consensus in order to reach full economic and trade partnership between the two countries. Meanwhile, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and Iranian Minister of Transportation Rostam Ghazemi discussed bilateral economic relations. President Assad stressed the importance of establishing new projects that would achieve the common strategic benefit for Syria and Iran and link the business sectors in both countries. Minister Ghazemi reiterated his country's firm position in supporting the steadfastness of the Syrian people in the face of the war against terrorism and American imperialism. Syrian Minister of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates Faisal Maqdad and Iranian Minister Qasimi also met and discussed issues of common interest between the two countries, stressing the need to upgrade economic relations between them to keep pace with the level of development of joint political relations. Iran and Syria had also signed four documents to boost cooperation in the fields of trade and industry during a visit of an Iranian delegation headed by the country's industry minister to Damascus last month. The documents were inked at the end of the two countries' joint economic and industrial committee meetings, which were held in the Syrian capital, Damascus. However, last week's important bilateral economic talks came simultaneously as Syria officially joined China's Intercontinental Belt and Road Initiative, defying strict U.S. unilateral punitive measures. Damascus's participation was initiated during a ceremony last Tuesday through the signing of a Memorandum of Understanding by Syrian Planning and International Cooperation Authority Chair Fadil Khalil and Chinese Ambassador to Syria Feng Biao. The initiative gets its name from the ancient Silk Road that once ran through Asia, with West Asia serving as a crossroads to Africa and Europe. The Iranian and Chinese trade pact signed last week with Syria will act as defining goals and guides to all three countries' projects, which will for sure deepen the working cooperation between them and strengthen the harmonization between Iran, Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative and the policies of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, while also strengthening Iranian and Chinese participation in the economic reconstruction of Syria.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Sara Saloum, independent journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Sara. Now, an Iranian delegation headed by Iranian Transport and Urban